Thank you, Charles. I'm interested in directives and the responses they receive in interaction as sites of authority in action and how it gets negotiated and worked out by the participants. The data that we're going to be looking at today comes from a collection of family mealtime conversations. So far I've got about 20 hours of data, but it's an ongoing collection. So I want to jump straight into looking at some data just to demonstrate really simply what a directive is and what compliance is. In this extract, 7-year-old Emily is sort of messing about with some chocolate that she's got, making funny noises, waving her arms about. Mum issues a directive on line 6 where she says enough, in the sense that she tells Emily to do something. And that's sort of the key identifier I'm using for directives. They actually tell someone to do something. And in response to that directive, Emily responds by putting her arms down and sitting properly. So you can see an immediate change in her embodied conduct just as a result of the directive having been issued, and she complied with the directive. She did what she was told. The other thing that we can see from this extract is that embodied actions can be treated as sequentially relevant. The change in the embodied conduct happened as a result of the directive. So you can, in certain circumstances, treat embodied responses as part of the turn-taking structure. I've been focusing recently on directives that are only issued once in a given sequence of talk, so not those that in response to resistance or defiance are then repeated and upgraded and sort of go on and on and on, just ones that are issued once, as in this case. And although you can see from this extract that it's perfectly possible to respond to a directive non-verbally, just with embodied conduct, I found it interesting that so many of the extracts I was looking at had both a verbal response and an embodied response to the directive, and it's those dual responses that I'm focusing on today. So if we take a look at another example, here we've got Mum sitting on the left, 5-year-old Lucy is at the top of the table, and then there's Dad and 8-year-old Daisy on the right hand side.
Guess what happens in school? Remember the students who get it wrong.
What did you say about chocolate milk and mouth for?
That's it is.
Okay, so in this case, Mum interrupts Daisy mid-TCU to issue her directive on line 11, what did you say about talking with her mouthful? Daisy's immediate response to this is to stop her ongoing talk and to actively and dramatically provide this display of compliance. She doesn't just quietly finish eating her mouthful and then continue talking. She straightens her back up and she chews in this really energetic fashion. She then says on line 15, I've finished. At the point when she says that, she still has a mouthful of food, so she quite clearly hasn't finished. And it's only once she said that that she actually goes on to crane her head back and, in a dramatic sort of performance-style way, demonstrate her compliance. The important thing to notice about this extract is that the compliance actually comes through the embodied conduct, not through the verbal turn. Saying, I've finished when you haven't, is quite clearly not complying with the directive. So if you don't need a verbal response to comply with the directive, why is it there? Well, if we look at what that verbal response actually is, the first thing it does is that it defies Mum's directive. Saying talking when you have a mouthful of food is quite clearly defying a directive to finish your mouthful. It challenges Mum's right to have issued the directive because it contradicts the assessment that Mum gave of Daisy's mouth. And it offers an alternative, although visibly inaccurate, assessment of having finished a mouthful. The basis for that alternative statement comes from the fact that Daisy has primary epistemic access to her own body or conduct. What Mum can observe as a third party won't be the same as what Daisy actually experiences. So given how confrontational that verbal response is, and the numerous examples I've got in my corpus of responses exactly like this, leading to upgraded and repeated directives, why doesn't it happen in this case? Well, I'd suggest that that's because Daisy's first response to the directive is an embodied move that shows compliance. It orients to Mum's utterance as a directive rather than just an information solicit about what Mrs. William had to say about talking with the mouthful, and it displays Daisy's orientation as being compliant with that directive. once she's shown this compliant orientation, Daisy then challenges the grounds for the directive and reformulates her mouthful as having been finished. And it's only once she's done this that she then goes on to fully comply with the directive. So the dangerous bit in this, the verbal resistance, is sandwiched in between the two performances of compliance. And by being in that position, its confrontational tone is moderated. I'd also suggest that the two stages to the embodied compliance, the performance of the chewing, then the verbal resistance, and then the actual compliance, having the compliance in two stages serves to mean that the compliance comes after Daisy's own formulation of the state of her mouth, rather than after Mum's directive. And so it's not directly sequentially responsive to the directive by the time compliance actually comes. If we take a look at another example, that should help to clarify it a little bit, I hope. In this case, we've got 4-year-old Jessica on the left, Mum in the middle, and 7-year-old Emily on the right.
Now, would you please finish your scoop?
I am thirsty. That's it.
That's
it.
Soup. No, that's a
spa. Okay. So, in this extract, Mum issues a directive on line 2, now would you please finish your soup? The first response is Jessica repeats, there's a quiet repeat of the object of the directive, soup. It's a minimal receipt. It doesn't display any orientation to either compliance or resistance, it just receipts the directive. What she then does is this lovely thing where she sort of pulls her sleeves up, which is a performance of getting ready to comply. It shows she's moving towards compliance, but she doesn't quite get there yet. She then comes in with this turn on line 7 of I am thirsty. This reformulates the drinking that she was doing prior to the directive as a normal part of mealtime behaviour. And it treats not eating as justified when one is thirsty. And on those grounds, it treats Mum's directive as being unreasonable, as though Jessica would have got round to eating eventually of her own accord. In this sense, Jessica's resisting Mum's right to have issued that directive. Jessica then spends 6.4 seconds with a bit more getting ready to comply. She gets a spoonful and she blows on it. And then she takes about the tiniest mouthful of soup I think I've ever seen, but it's compliance. And she then puts the spoon down, initiates a new topic of talk that Mum's perfectly happy to engage in without further reference back to the directive sequence. So like in the previous extract, the first orientation that's shown to the directive is a compliant one, but it doesn't in itself constitute compliance. The verbal utterance then challenges the grounds of the directive, resisting its projection of compliance, and it announces a state of being, I'm thirsty. In the light of saying she's thirsty, Jessica then takes a drink of soup. Now those two actions, saying I'm thirsty and taking a drink of soup, make sense on their own. You don't need a directive before it for those to make sense. So what we've got here is a really careful balance of complying, resisting, and acting under your own agency. And I'd suggest that all of these three different responses are made possible because of this first embodied response, because it provides space in which to issue the verbal turn that then reformulates what comes after as not necessarily solely responsive to the directive. For today, I'm calling this first initial response pre-compliance, in the sense of actions that move towards compliance without actually getting there. I don't mean to imply any sense of pre-sequence in terms of sequence organisation. It's just complying actions that aren't quite compliance. I've got an example now of what I hope you'll agree is pre-compliance. Dad asks Emily to eat nicely, which she does do, but it takes her about 30 seconds before she actually eats anything.
Thank you.
long extract, so if you just want to follow on your transcripts, I'll talk you through the key points. Dad issues a directive to Emily to eat nicely on line 4. Between lines 8 to 20, Emily engages in an extensive series of actions, all of which could be taken as a precursor to complying with a directive to eat nicely. At the time when the directive is issued, she's got a mouthful of food. So on line 8, she puts the cutlery down. Impolite to put more food in a mouth that's already full. On line 9 to 10, she takes a drink. And on line 11, the gustatory sort of signals that the problem of an overfull mouth is now being overcome, and she's one step closer to compliance. The pardon me on line 15 after her small burp is an orientation to politeness, something that's inherent in eating nicely. She then tidies up the eating area and licks her fingers, sort of clearing the detritus of her previous not nice eating, and so sets herself up as completely ready to now eat nicely. She picks up her cutlery, and finally, on line 21, 30 seconds after the directive was issued, she begins to eat. Like in the previous extracts, Mum and Dad then refocus away, start a new topic about when Jessica's returning to the table, and don't orient to the completion of the directive sequence. All of Emily's actions are slow and deliberate and have sort of the character of a performance about them. It demonstrates her orientation to compliance without getting there for, in this case, quite a long time. In interactional terms, what this serves to do is to delay the point of compliance away from direct adjacency to the directive. Even though, in this case, the parents are perfectly happy to wait 30 seconds for her to eat, she still managed to take quite a long time about it. So just to summarise the key points about pre-compliance, it treats the prior utterance as a directive, and it shows an orientation of compliance towards it without actually being compliant. It projects full compliance as being in the offing or upcoming, so they'll get there eventually. And in so doing, what it does is it forestalls an upgraded or repeated directive. And finally, what it does is shift full compliance away from direct adjacency to the directive, so diluting the sense in which it can be understood to be responsive to it. Now, another example, again, of pre-compliance with the verbal resistance. We're back with the other family. So there's 5-year-old Lucy at the end and 8-year-old Daisy on the right.
I'm speaking it, please. You need a piece of ice. It's very cold out there. Very, very, very cold.
It's more colder than the snow.
No, not quite that cold, because it would snow, right? It hasn't been raining. He was saying, have you been...
So Dad issues a directive to Lucy in two parts. Don't pick at it, please. You need to eat it nicely. Interestingly here, Lucy's first response to it isn't the embodied pre-compliance. Here, it's actually the verbal resistance turn. In response to, you need to eat it nicely, she says, I am. Note that in the absence of a preceding embodied display of compliance, Lucy interpolates particles of laughter into her verbal resistance to help manage the delicacy of resisting a directive. I think this does help to demonstrate how dangerous it can be for a child to sort of defy a directive that their parents given, and that children orient to the delicacy with which they have to manage complying and resisting directives through having the laughter when you don't have the preceding embodied display of compliance. In this case, embodied pre-compliance does come afterwards and slightly in overlap with the end of her verbal turn, so it's not too late in being there. And she then does do the pre-compliance. She lets the food fall off her fingers, sort of moves towards getting there. In previous extracts, the person issuing the directive has tended to wait for pre-compliance to move into full compliance before initiating a topic launch. However, Dad here launches a new topic on line 18. It could be that Dad was attempting to initiate talk with Daisy while Lucy complied. He was the only parent at the table at the time, so that could account for the difference, I'm not sure. But like the previous extracts, topic shift is initiated by the directive speaker. It doesn't orient to the completion or non-completion of the directive sequence, and it refocuses the conversation away from what they were talking about. The difference here is that all that's happened so far is pre-compliance, not actual compliance. Lucy does a little more pre-compliance when she picks up the spoon and puts it into her bowl, but the really interesting line here is line 22, where she lifts her spoon out of the bowl with no food on it, effectively undoing the pre-compliance work she's just done without having complied. They then go on to engage in the new topic of conversation.
5 minutes.
So delaying the response beyond the topic shift means that she's no longer responsive to the directive. and it's if the recipient now chose to do what they had been directed to do, it's under their own sort of self-motivated behaviour, not because of the will of the director speaker. In fact, in this case, Lucy does go on to eat a mouthful of food on line 30, but I think we'd be hard-pressed to show with sequence organisation how eating a mouthful of food down here could be responsive to a directive up there, considering everything that had happened in the middle. Pre-compliance, therefore, may offer recipients a chance to delay compliance beyond the point where you actually need to give it at all. It's really easy with data like family meal times to view interactional phenomena as an artifact of the status differences between adults and children in the conversation. But issues about agency and control over your own actions are live concerns for all participants, not just for children. And in this final extract that I'd like to show you, Mum issues a directive to Dad. Dad shows embodied pre-compliance, a verbal turn that reformulates the action, and then he goes on to fully comply with the directive.
Is it rats and swimming today?
No.
It's brownies.
Come on, eat another bit of broccoli now.
Mum's directive for Dad to eat another bit of broccoli, darling. There's then a short inserted repair sequence where they clarify exactly who the recipient of the directive was. But as soon as that's been established on line 7 by Mum's nod, Dad launches into this display of pre-compliance. Note, he doesn't just stab a piece of broccoli and put it on his plate. He searches for a piece of broccoli. So it has that element of performance that the other bits of pre-compliance did. He then announces, ooh, which is a noticing sort of an ostensibly acceptable piece of broccoli that's caught his eye. His exclamation has the character of an announcement that was prompted by his search for broccoli rather than by Mum's directive. And in so doing, it reformulates any future taking of broccoli as something that Dad's doing because he saw a piece he liked rather than because Mum told him to do it. Once he's done that, he then goes on to take the piece of broccoli and comply with the directive. So what I'm hoping this demonstrates is that issues of control of actions when you're directing someone are live concerns for all participants in interaction, not necessarily just for children or other participants that may occupy traditionally subordinated statuses. So, in a really final summary, I've noticed something that I'm calling pre-compliance, which is actions that move towards compliance without actually getting there. The interactional purpose of pre-compliance seems to be to delay the point of actual compliance away from direct adjacency to the directive, sometimes rendering it unnecessary altogether. Mixed in with all of this, you've got the verbal resistance, which challenges the grounds on which the directive was issued. Typically, those tend to be announcements of a state of being that draw on the recipient's own primary epistemic access to their own body or conduct. And crucially, they reformulate the ongoing action as being self-motivated rather than because of the will of the director speaker. And finally, a combination of verbal resistance and embodied compliance means that directive recipients can reclaim the epistemic authority to control their own actions, sometimes in the case of avoiding compliance altogether. But even if, as in most cases, you still need to comply, it's now being done on your own terms rather than because you were told to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, perfectly timed. Thank you, Alex. So time for questions, observations, points. Yes.
I really like to ask the question. The question would be, is this a parent's framework or a child's framework?
In what sense?
So the event was orientated to these notions of compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about the parents orientated to that or the children orientated? Because I got the sense that maybe sometimes the children would want to
In the sense that Dad was showing the correct way to comply with the directive to demonstrate good parenting for the children in that last extract, you mean? I'd suggest that if he was demonstrating good compliance with the directive, then why did he need the verbal turn that reformulated it? Yes, in the sense that there's definitely directives sort of project that compliance is what should happen. My point with these extracts was that you can comply without needing a verbal turn at all. You can, if someone sort of, if you on to pull the chair in, they can just pull the chair in. If you ask them to pass the ketchup, they can just pass the ketchup. It doesn't need a verbal comment. And so I was interested in why that verbal comment was there. And it seems to be to manage doing what you were told without subjugating your own will to someone else's.
Yes, Nick.
Just pursuing a question. Just, is there any issue you have in doing the analysis with adults and young children when you yourself are an adult? In the sense that you're invoking things like the child's eating slowly,
yeah.
Use a silly voice, they're not really complying.
Mm.
Are you kind of a proxy authoritarian parent?
I'm
an analyst. The child's not complying,
yeah.
The child's eating fine, the child's delayed.
I'm definitely trying not to do that. Yeah.
That was the point of the Barry's question, that there's,
right.
Are you forcing a set of adult categories onto a set of people who maybe aren't organising their conduct through those sorts of categories and terms?
So in the sense that the child may not be sort of pre-complying and complying as two separate things, they could just be getting around to it on their own.
Yeah, but they're not being slow.
True.
I mean, your ability to see that they're slow in the opposite of something is built, posted on quite a lot of stuff.
Part of what it's posited on is the extracts I've got of repeated directives and what causes a parent to issue another one, a stronger, more forceful directive. And they really don't allow much time at all. So, yes, there probably is definitely a sense in which I'm looking at it as an adult, but I couldn't show the comparison extracts here of the ones that do go horribly wrong and you get sort of like parents eventually just moving the child into the right place because they're so fed up with them messing around. And if children can use the careful timing of pre-compliance to avoid that repeat directive coming in, then perhaps it's not just me looking at it as an adult and saying they're being slow.
Andrew.
People who know me will know that I never mind showing my absolute ignorance, so please feel free to treat me like I'm stupid. But you made a point of saying that you're calling them pre-compliance,
yeah.
But you don't want to suggest they're pre's.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know what you meant by not treating them as pre's, even though
right.
You're calling them pre-compliance.
In the sense that if you're looking for a pre-invitation, would sort of be, what are you doing next Saturday?
Mm-hmm.
And then get a go-ahead to issue an invitation. The pre-compliance isn't looking for a response from the parent. It's actually trying to stop that response coming.
Okay.
So it's not a pre in a sense to try and get a go-ahead or a hedge or a block. It's just give me space.
Well, what if it's a go-ahead for the child to do their own?
Yeah. That it could definitely be. Maybe I should be looking at it in terms of pre-sequence. I mean, I called it pre-compliance just to sort of emphasised that it was different from compliance. I guess I hadn't considered that it could actually be doing some form of pre.
No, Charles is shaking his head.
Oh, right.
He's all right.
Yeah. See, Charles doesn't mind telling me something. That's all right.
Tim Rappin, back.
Yes, sorry, it's me. I want to go back to extract 6, because I think it's really interesting. Because I think it works, and I get why you've whacked an adult one in to say that you've got these existential categories. But how else would this man do that work? The mum comes in and says, another bit of God.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of level of, what would it look like not to comply very, very smoothly? Would
yeah.
it be, you know what I mean? There's a kind
yeah.
of level of, again, how you're seeing that is kind of tied into it. And with the rest of them, they work really well. This one, I'm just not sure. And I know why
okay.
there's a contrast. I think to come back to your point earlier on, you do need those deeming codes where it marks up for this to be really very, very true. I don't know.
There are certainly some elements about dad's response that are different to the children. He doesn't resist mum's right to have issued the directive. Which is sort of, so how could you say that he'd done that one a bit differently? I take the point. I do need to go back and have another look at that one to see how it differs.
John Ray.
This is really interesting work that you're doing, and it goes to some very fundamental issues about the organisation of choice action. I've got another doubt about some of the way in which you're building your analysis there. And it's really to do with whether resistance quite is the thing that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, extracts 4 and 5. These don't seem to me to look like instructions to do anything straight away. So I mean, it seems to me that in both of those cases, what the kids doing is, I mean, they are doing the niceness that's being required of them. I mean, it isn't like sort of now immediately do this thing nicely,
mm-hmm.
but eat nicely, please. That doesn't seem to me to require any response straight away. And I mean, I take all the points you made about what's happening, and I think it's very interesting that we're getting talk interwoven with the body conduct, but I don't quite see that it's, especially in these cases, I don't quite see that it's resistance that's the most important.
In the case of extract 4, conversation stops for 30 seconds, and the parents just watch until Emily actually has eaten something, and as soon as she puts something in her mouth, they immediately start talking about the other daughter. So to me, it did seem to be a sense in which the whole conversation was held up until she had eaten nicely, which I think speaks to the fact that it was an immediate directive that it needed to have some compliance shown towards it before they could move on.
Well, isn't that a lapse in talk? I mean, it isn't as if there's a conversation that's stopped for something else to happen. It just seems to be less. I don't know if it's like it, but it doesn't sound like there's a lapse in talk.
I find it extremely rare to find lapses that long in the family data. I mean, if it had been sort of 5 or 10 seconds, then I'd absolutely have agreed. But 30 seconds for this kind of data is a long lapse. Admittedly, in this extract, there probably is some sense in which mum and dad have finished and they are waiting for Emily to finish. So perhaps I need to look at sort of other instances where there are sort of parents waiting for children to finish and see how that affects the sort of the lapse time that there might be. But my sense of it was that they had stopped and they were waiting for him to comply with the directive, and the fact that there was sort of an instant resumption of a new topic of conversation as soon as she had eaten.
My memory, if I can jump in, of that particular stretch was that the two adults were sitting there, eyes all but rolling and fumes coming out of their heads, and as it were, they're in frozen animation until this damn girl gets that stuff damn well eaten, and they weren't going to engage in anything to put the moral pressure on her. These are perhaps not very CA terms, I'll give you that. But nevertheless, there was suspension of action until, it wasn't a lapse, it was suspension until something happened which would count as the production of that directed talk, that directed action. Jump in there. Yes?
I thought it was interesting when you talked about the idea of demonstrating doing pre-compliance,
mm-hmm.
because of course, in order to eat something, you need to do these actions.
Yeah.
In some of these cases, there was a clear add-on of demonstration,
mm-hmm.
and I think that would be, I hope that's something that you're looking at, because that's the difference between just picking or completely demonstrating and complying. I think that's really interesting. I wonder if you have anything else to say on that.
I don't actually have any much other than I've noticed it in these extracts. My initial focus on directives was the verbal responses to them, and it's a fairly recent thing that I started pulling in the body conduct, but it's definitely something I do want to look at more, because I think it manages so much of the issues of control and authority are done through just a glance or through when you choose to eat and how you choose to eat.
Let's stop there and thank Alex one more time. And we thank Mirta as well. We start off with